Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about page allocation, which we said was the same as page replacement, because typically we imagine we have this cache, the cache is full, and since it's full, to put something in memory, we have to remove something else. We talked about, well, how do we choose what to replace? And we said if we want to maximize the hit rate while being reactive, we had this algorithm called Blaze Min, where we just looked at what would be used furthest in the future. And we learned that, well, that really isn't possible. Instead, what we're going to need to do is predict the future using the past. So we need to monitor what accesses are happening now. And we have this idea of tracking these referenced or access bits, indicating what's been recently accessed. And the mechanism we propose for that is I put an extra bit in page table entries, and something's tracked similarly for things accessed not via page tables. That would be set when there was an access. We learned how that the hardware could do that, or we could do that manually by temporarily marking page table entries as not present. We also could do something similar with dirty bits to track when things were written to. And now that we have a way of tracking when things are accessed, we can try to implement a replacement policy that, you know, does some good things for hit rate, but doesn't involve knowing the future, but we make some guesses. We have some heuristics. And the big heuristic we had was this locality one. We assumed if we just access something, we're likely to access it again soon. And this gave us the idea that the policy we want to implement is least recently used. But the sort of tracking we were doing with these, just having these referenced bits, that's not precise enough to implement least recently used efficiently. And just we just can't implement it efficiently exactly, but we can approximate. And we talked about two different approximations for it. One was this idea of second chance, where we, you know, we choose a page that we haven't looked at in a while, and we'd see if it was referenced. And if it was referenced, then we'd skip it, otherwise we'd use it. And we had Linux's seek policy, which is kind of a refinement of this, where we said, well, I don't want to see if it was referenced since the last time I looked at it, you know, to consider it for replacement. That's going to be too long. So instead, I'll have an active list of pages I care about checking for references. And I'll have the active ones, the ones I've already looked at, and it hasn't been a while. I'll let them go through that list slowly without me checking for accesses to sort of control how sensitive I am. And then we talked about, well, we have these ways of sort of approximating LRU. They do a kind of good job. But we also mentioned LRU, you know, it's a guess, and it was based on this locality assumption, and there are things that programs commonly do that are bad for that assumption. So we have these cases where LRU failed, where we might want to do some different policy because LRU is going to do something that's not good. We're going to keep pages cached that, in fact, aren't going to be needed over pages that are. So those were what we covered last time. So questions about things we covered last time, or perhaps the quiz? Yes?
Could you explain the question
to, option B on question two? On the quiz. So let's look at our quiz. So we have question two here. So here we have a file X. I should have said there are four processes, but I think that's probably clear. And the file X, we have it mapped in processes A and B, and C has an open file descriptor for it, which presumably means that it's in the process of like reading and writing it occasionally. And then we replace part of that cache part of the file. So that part of the cache part of the file might be in processes A and B, so we'll need to change their page tables. It's not in process C, it's not in the user part of memory. It's true that process C can access the file by reading or writing, but the way that's going to work is the read or write system call is going to look up in the kernel data structure that tracks what part of the file is cached, where to look, and it's going to find out, oh, there's not a place for this right now, I have to go to disk. We aren't going to actually change the page table in response to that because there's nothing that process C can access without a system call anyways. So we can just handle that by editing kernel data structures that we know the read and write system call will check rather than just going to some memory location. For process D, the page table is going to change because part of the page replacement is going to be making the new heap usable. And data could be written to disk because it's possible that part of that file was modified earlier, possibly much earlier, and we need to make sure it gets to disk because if we don't do that now, we're never going to remember those modifications, and that would be really bad if you wrote to a file and closed the file, and then you looked at your disk the next day and the file didn't have those changes. You'd be really annoyed. So that answer that question? Yes. So question, how would process C know about changes that A or B made? And when process C accesses the file, it's going to do something like, say, this read system call here. And the implementation of that system call is going to make sure it checks the latest version of the data, which is going to be the version that A and B are changing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, does that mean if it knows that something is going to be written to the file, then it waits pretty much?
Question, does the read system call wait if it knows something is going to be written to the file? So I wouldn't say that. The read system call is going to look at the latest version of the file. If that was written to in cache in the past, it's going to have those changes. If those changes aren't in cache yet, like let's say program A is in the middle of like this loop here, right? We're going to see whatever of those have actually finished so far. Does that answer your question? So the question is, when the batch program is writing to a file, does the kernel cache the file? So if we're implementing the LRU policy, the file is recently used because we just accessed the cache data for it. So we would cache it. And one of the purposes of Linux's exception policy is to avoid doing that if we're only writing. But otherwise, with LRU, it's a use. It's a write is a use. So we are right. So it would count. We would cache it. The question, in order to write to the file, is the cache always necessary? So, no, we could imagine making write work. We could imagine making read and write work without the cache. But generally, if we have the cache, we're going to have them use it, right? Does that make sense? But for example, on Linux, there's a special option you can patch to open which says, don't use the cache. I want things to be slow, but access the device directly. That's an option you have, but usually that's not very useful. But because we typically use the cache, that's sort of our default, this is a case where that would kind of break down because we're only writing it, and probably we aren't going to read those files soon. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
What's the underlying difference in implementation between mmap and read?
What's the underlying difference between mmap and read? I guess I would say mmap, like we're setting something up and the reads happen later. Read, we know the copy, read, the kernel code is actually doing the copying, right? And it's copying into some data, some space that the user set up. The kernel's not setting up the memory based on the read call, like presumably it set it up earlier for some other reason. But the implementation's accessing the same data internally. But the kernel doesn't need to set page table entries to do that. It can just look up where did I store this earlier and probably has a more direct way of accessing whatever address it happens to be at right now, assuming it's cached.
And so does read write to the heap?
Question, where does read write to? So read has an argument that says where to send data to, and it writes wherever that points. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So
So the question is, if we're writing to one file, like piece by piece, wouldn't it be better to keep that page that we're writing to lots of times cached? Yes. I don't think that really applies to very large number of files, because each of those files like needs to have a separate pages, right? And that's why I phrased the question that way. It's true that if we were writing like to one small file, lots, then yeah, the cache would be, LRU would be really helpful there. But if we're writing to lots of files, like, well, we're probably not using any of the files we're probably using them like maybe each page a couple of times, but in very quick succession, and then we're not using them anymore.
Okay.
Right, because if you think of how you'd write to a file, you're probably just, you know, writing the first kilobyte, the second kilobyte, third kilobyte, fourth kilobyte, and then you're done, sort of thing, right? Make sense? Okay. Other questions? Okay. That's on the quiz. Okay, so it's on the quiz. So we mentioned about implementing these nice replacement policies, and one property we had is that these were, as I pointed out, sort of reactive, meaning that we only actually put things in our cache when there's an actual access. We don't do any work to our cache to remove or change things unless something forces us to do something, generally to bring something in, so we have to like remove things. And this is not, you know, a restriction we actually have. I just had it to, you know, make things simpler, and it allowed us to say there was an optimal policy, but we don't have to assume that we can only act when the program forces us to. And in fact, it's probably pretty good not to do that, because often we have some sort of downtime in a typical system. Like there's some time when, you know, we're not busy with trying to let programs do things. If you think of like my system right now, right, there's extra CPU time that could be used to do stuff to prepare for the future. So operating systems do a bunch of things that are more proactive, where we don't always load on demand. We do something better than sort of doing all our actions when the program is trying to need more memory. And there's one key sort of pattern by which we can do better. So let's say you see a program access page 4 of a file, then 5, and then 6. You can make an educated guess that probably the program is going to be accessing pages 7, 8, and 9 pretty soon. This is not always going to be true. Maybe the program is going to stop right there. But it's very often going to be true, and this is a very common pattern. And many operating systems implement this guessing. They'll do something to monitor when programs are doing these sequential accesses and act on them by reading in pages 7, 8, and 9 before the program actually tries to access them. And generally, it will try to stay ahead of where the program is. So when the program has its page faults, all it does is set a page table entry and it's done. It doesn't, at most. It doesn't need to actually read in the data. It's already done in advance. And this idea is called read ahead. So we're reading ahead of where the program is. And this, in practice, tends to improve performance a lot. It's not guaranteed, because if our guess is wrong, we're spending time reading things in from the disk that we don't need to, and we're also evicting things that we shouldn't have, right? If we don't actually access this thing, we're replacing something else with page 7, and if that was a bad guess, well, we might have preferred to have something else in the cache. But usually this works, and this works very well, so most operating systems implement some version of read ahead. Some questions on read ahead? So there are other ways we can be proactive. So I told you, when we're evicting a page, we have to do a bunch of work. Like we might have to write it back to disk, we might have to change a whole bunch of page table entries to make sure they don't point to it anymore. But we can do better than that. So we can proactively free pages. So a common thing OSs will do is they'll try to free a bunch of pages in advance. So when they have to do a page replacement, they have pages that are already removed from page tables, already empty. So they're just ready to use right away. And the idea is that usually they can identify pages that are, you know, really unlikely to be used soon. And the benefit of doing the work of clearing them from page tables sort of while the system's kind of not busy is very helpful, because that means that when the system is busy and you actually need them for other data, you can allocate them really quickly. And similarly, one thing we want to do is for writing out what I call dirty pages. So dirty means sort of, you know, so modified compared to the version on disk. Modified compare versus version in permanent storage. So we have a page in cache that's been changed. We need to write that out eventually. And so far we've been talking that we're going to do that when we replace it with something. But we can do it earlier, especially since often we have some periods when the system is not so busy. That would be a good time to write it out. So we'll just write it out, you know, sometime earlier. Also, if you actually wait until like the last possible moment, you'll be very disappointed on like a power failure. Because this might mean that, you know, if I have a power failure and the operating system has kept, you know, part of a file I'm working on cached for a day, well, I will be missing a day's worth of work because it won't be written back. So to avoid this, operating systems will proactively write things back on a much shorter schedule so you aren't so disappointed. Yes?
Would the concept of dirty pages be analogous to the concept of dirty bits from cache memory?
Question, is the concept of dirty bits analogous to the concept of dirty bits from cache memory? Yes. So dirty pages are pages, physical pages in the cache that have their dirty bit set, basically.
Okay.
Just like blocks in the cache have their dirty bit. And the same thing applies that we need to write them back. And in processor caches, we never really talked about writing them earlier than we had to. But when we're talking about more permanent storage, you know, that's where it's different, where we have sort of different priorities there. Other questions? So there's this whole bunch of proactive things, and most OSs do some set of these, maybe not all of them, but all of these can be helpful for performance. And sort of the big thing we're taking advantage of is that we can do a lot of this work when either, you know, programs don't need the CPU, or some of this stuff mostly uses like an I/O device, and so we can do while a program is using the CPU, like writing things back to disk. So we talked about our page replacement. So we have our page cache, that's our program memory and files. We had this sort of assumption of temporal locality, which gave us LRU variants. We had special cases when things didn't work for LRU very well. And we also mentioned, oh, there's a whole bunch of things we can do where we act in advance, you know, sort of predicting what we should do while the system's hopefully less busy, rather than waiting until the program needs us to do something. And I briefly alluded to earlier on that, oh, we can handle, like we were talking about optimizing miss rate, there are other policies we could have. We're not going to have time to talk about them, but you know, there's other things we could try to optimize, like fairness. I just didn't talk about how we do that, but you know, that would be a different design. Some questions about virtual memory stuff before we go into talking about I/O. Okay, so let's talk about I/O. So let's say I have a program, I have a keyboard and disk, and the program's going to use the operating system to talk to the keyboard and the disk. And we kind of, when we talked early in the semester about exceptions, we said, oh, I press a key on the keyboard, the operating system gets an exception for that, and it's going to have, generally, a buffer for keyboard input that's waiting for some program to be read. And usually we'll put that in the buffer right away. So keypress happens, we're going to fill up that buffer. And at some point later on, the program's going to read, say from our keyboard, and we're going to copy that via the buffer. We could also have it be the case that the program asks to read before the buffer's full, in which case the read will happen, and then the program's going to wait until the buffer gets full, and the buffer's going to be filled. We can have something similar happen with a file. If I ask to read a character from a file, you know, we're going to fulfill that from a buffer in the kernel. That buffer happens to be the page cache we just talked about, those cache pages. So if we don't have that already, we're going to initiate reading that part of the data from the disk, and then we're going to satisfy the read using that buffer. And if the buffer's already there, the read's simpler, we just copy from the buffer. Questions about sort of this procedure for how reading works. So in each case, we're going via some kernel buffer for the device. In one case, the kernel buffer we saw is the page cache, is the, those cache pages from a file. Yes?
Do we need to send a command to the disk to know which play it's retrieving?
Do we need to send a command to the disk to know it's retrieving? Yes. So the disk, we're going to have to tell the disk to do a read. It's not just going to do it for us like the keyboard. Other questions? Okay. So we could also have writes. So if we do a write, let's say I write some stuff to the network, like then you know I ask to print a character, that's a write system call. The way that's typically going to work is that we're going to put it in some buffer that the kernel manages that when ready, we're going to send to the actual network. So again, the way things are going to work is we're going to have some buffers that actually store the data waiting to go out for writes. And similar for talking to disk, when I write a character to a file, it goes in a buffer. We learn that that buffer is our page cache. And eventually that buffer gets written out to disk. So this is typically the way I/O works, is that we have this intermediate buffer. Do we have to do this? No, but this is almost always the design that's been chosen. So you have these kernel buffers. And so that's something that's sort of part of our file interface is we have these buffers for talking to normal regular files or other devices. And I note that this is not sort of the only sort of buffer storing data waiting to be read or written. If you use like cout and printf or cn and scanf, they have their own buffers in addition to the buffers kept in the kernel. Why do they do that? Well, they have their buffers, so they can call read and write as often. So they can call read and get a whole bunch of stuff and only give you part of it. Or they can, you know, or you can print out a lot of things and they can call write just once. And similarly, the kernel has buffers because the device, you know, doesn't communicate the set, you know, in the same way as like one read call matches to getting one thing from the device. It's sort of mismatched. Right? With the keyboard, like we need to store the stuff as it comes in. We can't just wait for a read call to get it. So we have two different buffers commonly, if you're using like cout for the same communication, that's just how things are. And we have this interface here, and this interface is implemented with what we'll call device drivers. So device drivers are the part of the kernel code that knows how to talk to the actual device. And we're going to talk about how that works today. And I mentioned we have this sort of file interface for you know, sitting on top of that, and there's on Unix, there's kind of two ways that that works. So we have, generally, we have our programs, like we're going to do read, write, and map to access files, which could be regular files on disk or represent devices. And there's we have our regular files, and typically we have lots of different regular files on one device, and that's going to be managed by a file system, which is going to be our topic for Thursday. And we also have device files, which directly represent a device, like a keyboard, where we don't have that sort of file storage that's split up, like regular files. And both of these are going to use device drivers to actually communicate with the hardware. So let's talk a bit about device files here, since this is probably not really something we've seen very directly. So device are files are files. So on Unix, they have this open read, write, and close interface. And the device driver is going to implement that interface that the user programs are going to use. And they're going to implement that, you know, in different ways, depending on the type of device we're talking to. So for example, on my desktop, there are a whole bunch of device files for a wide variety of devices. For example, there's a dev sound PCM in some characters is for audio playback. So I can open that and write some data, and it goes out my speakers as sound. There's device files that represent my hard drives and SSDs. I can open that and read and write to the hard drive directly, not just pieces of it that are regular files. There are files that represent the mouse and keyboard. I can open that and read from it to get key presses or mouse movements. There's a device that represents this the screen. I can open that and somehow write to it to display stuff on the screen. And obviously the way writing is going to work for, or reading is going to work for each of these, is going to be different. But it's all the same common interface. Now, sometimes reading and writing isn't enough. So for example, if we think of our audio playback device, there's a lot of ways I could represent audio data. And I might want some extra operations. And so there are some extra system calls that are commonly implemented. Probably the most notable is IOCTL. And basically, Unix decided we're going to have this generic IO control call, which is going to mean different things depending on the devices. And this is for extra operations, like what if I want to set the format the audio is in if my hardware supports multiple ones? Or what if I want to check whether the headphones are plugged in? That's where we would add these sorts of operations that don't fit in the read and write paradigm. And there's lots of these. Like in the terminal, I'll have something similar, usually with a different library call. Like, do I want to echo text back to the user automatically, or is that something that shouldn't happen? Or if like I have an optical disk drive, is the disk tray, could I open the disk tray? Is it open? Is there a disk inside it? Those sorts of queries we want some extra calls for. They don't really work naturally with read and write, so we'll just have some extra calls for that. And another thing you'll sometimes see is that we might just have extra multiple files to control the same hardware, when that makes sense. So questions about sort of why we might want things beyond read and write? So we have these read and write calls and this IOCTL call, and what they need to do is going to vary tremendously between devices. So we're going to need some way of having them specified. And our device driver is going to implement these read and write operations however it wants. And on Linux, the way this works is they have this table of pointers to functions. If this were an object-oriented language, this would be like an abstract base class that would be inherited from. And this means each device driver implements read and implements write and implements IOCTL however is appropriate for the device. So we're going to do different things to, if it's a keyboard versus an audio device, for example, in these implementations. And the device driver decides what that code is. Okay, so questions on this idea that we'll have sort of a custom version of what the file operations do for each device file. So I sort of showed device files that were using via read and write, that sort of were accessing directly. Commonly on Unix-like systems, including Linux, they want to have a special case for things that are used by the page cache, namely hard drives. Because for hard drives, the operation we're doing, it isn't like read or write. We're like loading a page from the disk or writing a page to the disk, and that doesn't fit naturally with read and write, which take, you know, a size in bytes. So on. So Unix traditionally distinguishes between what are called block devices, you know, versus what are called character devices. So character devices You know, the device driver is written in terms of read and write, which are read and write bytes. For block devices, the device driver is written in terms of what the page cache expects. So they read and write pages, because they're meant to be used by the page cache, not directly by read and write calls. So for a keyboard, you don't want this, right? For a keyboard, we read and write key presses, which are bytes, or read key presses, which are bytes. But for a hard drive, we read and write these big chunks. So we want something that the page cache is better for the page cache to use. We don't want to have to deal with, what if you read a page and a half? We're just not going to support that. We're going to have the page cache handle dealing with it. And on Linux, if you're implementing a block device, you're basically just going to implement this read or write page operation. And the page cache will handle, you know, caching your stuff for you based on that. So, yes? Why does the processor not handle the block device operations? We'll talk about how the hardware that handles it, these operations, works. So I'm just telling you, the device driver is the code that knows how to talk to the hardware. We'll talk about where the processor is and isn't doing work in a bit. But there are places where the processor is going to need to do work to support these I/O operations, and we're also going to have some additional hardware to support these I/O operations. That answer your question? Okay. So let's talk about just sort of what's in a device driver. And we're going to think of two parts for a device driver. We'll have what I'll call the top half. And this is where we get a read or a write operation, either from a read or write call or from the page cache, like evicting something and bringing something in. And we handle that. That's going to be the top half. We'll also have the bottom half, which is the part which runs from an exception handler. So something like a key press, we mentioned, triggers an exception. That's going to happen implemented by our bottom half. And this is sort of what I'm going to show you here. It's not the only way we can make device drivers, but this is the typical pattern we see. So we're going to get IO to request. And I'm going to show you what happens in XV6 to be very concrete. So XV6 has these device files. And like Linux, it has a table of operations. Unlike Linux, that table is very short. It's a read and a write. There's no IOCTL. There's many less arguments. But it's the same idea. So we have these, the struct, which has these two operations defined. And we have an array of them. And they take the file they're operating on and also how much to read or write. We have these array of devices. And the index into the array we call the device number. And the file on disk is going to have an index into this array. So we're going to have like a special file called console, which is going to indicate a particular index of this array. And the OS is going to know when you open that special file, it's going to read the disk and say, oh, this is not data stored on disk. This is the special file console that I use this array of file operations for. And it's going to access that special operation. This is similar to what Linux does. So we store on disk just something which says, use device number X when accessing this file rather than data. And then we identify device number X by looking up in an array like this. So you might say, so what about these operations? So we're going to look at how the console works. So the console is XV6's device file that represents the keyboard for reading and the screen for writing. So you read from it to read from the keyboard, you write to it to write to the keyboard. And at boot, they set the write operation and the read operation for this device to be a function called console write and console read. And console is just the number one. So device ID 1 is this console. When you write to it, it calls console write. When you read from it, it calls console read. And we're going to look at console read. And console read is this top half here. So that implements this top half here for reading from the keyboard. Yes?
What device is console write addressing?
What device is console write addressing? It is the screen. In XV6, it turns out that that's really two devices, but it's the screen. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Sorry?
Besides the screen.
So in XV6, with QMU, the output to the terminal window that QMU opens is, I believe, different than output to the normal output in the terminal, the original terminal. Yeah, I believe those are actually different devices. I'm not 100% sure, but if I recall correctly, they're different. One looks like a serial device and one looks like a VGA device. We were talking about hardware, where serial is an interface where we would plug a connector, kind of similar to USB, into a computer and into a standalone terminal. So that's what one of them is imitating, and the other is imitating an old interface for displays called VGA. If I recall correctly, I'm not 100% sure that's what it is, but I believe so. Other questions? Okay, so we're gonna look at console read. So console read, it's gonna get its request. So we see how it got its request. It got its request because we set up that read function in that array, and we're gonna look that up and know to go to this device driver. And the device driver is gonna check first, can I get the read from the buffer? So we're gonna have some buffer of keyboard input. I'm gonna show how it's filled in later. And if it's satisfied from the buffer, we're done. Otherwise, we're going to put the thread to sleep. On some other types of devices, we might send an IO operation, but for the keyboard, that doesn't make sense because the keyboard's always reading. We don't have to trigger the read. But like for a hard drive, we would have to do that. So the logic in that console read function, it has this part where it checks, do we have more input? And R and W are indices in the buffer for where we're reading and where we're writing. So if they're equal, we don't have any more to read. And if they're not equal, we have stuff that we haven't read that's been written. And if they're equal, we just sleep. We put the process to sleep, let something else run. Until we get woken up, which is going to happen in the bottom half of the device driver. And when we do have input, we're going to copy the data to the buffer that was passed in to read, and assuming that we read everything we're supposed to read, we're going to return. So here's what that code looks like here. So remember we have this dest array, so this is what the user passed in to read. So we're going to copy from the buffer into that dest array, and we're going to track where we are in as far as, you know, the user asked for n characters. We're going to keep track of n. And when either we decremented n to 0, so we've read the number of characters the user requested, or we reached a new line, then we're going to be done. Otherwise, we're going to go back to that code I showed you earlier, where we're going to say, is there more stuff in the buffer? If so, you know, keep going. Otherwise, sleep. So we're going to end up doing something where we store some data in the buffer. If the result's complete, we return. Otherwise, we go back to putting the thread to sleep, waiting for more data to be in the buffer, and then copying the next part until we're satisfied this finishing condition here, that we reach a new line or n is 0. Yes? What is constant lock? This is just a lock. What is constant lock? This is a lock to make sure one thread at a time accesses input. Because we have like input.r, which you also saw earlier, right? We need to make sure that we have proper synchronization for reading and writing that, and that's what the lock is for. Does that answer your question? Yes. What exactly is N? N is the number that was, the size that was passed into the read system call. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Or I guess I should say N is initially the size that was passed into the read system call, but note that we decrement it here. So we're keeping track of how many we have left, starting with the number that was passed in. Other questions? Okay, so you see here that this top half, the implementation of read, doesn't actually do anything about talking to the keyboard. All we're doing is copying from a buffer and going to sleep until something wakes us up. We don't actually deal with talking to the device. There's no code in here which knows how the keyboard works. All we know is how the other half of the device driver works. So we're just waiting for the buffer to full, copying from that buffer, and if we're done, you know, return, otherwise go back to the beginning, repeat, until we're actually done with that single read system call. So all the interesting work of communicating the device happens in the exception handler. So let's talk about that. That's going to be our bottom half. So first we have to get an interrupt from the device. And if you look in TRAP, there's a case for the keyboard. So this is the TRAP number for the keyboard is TIRQ0 plus IRQ keyboard. That's the TRAP number for that. And in that case, we go to this keyboard inter function, which handles the reading from the keyboard device. And then we call this LAPIC EIO, which I assume stands for Local Advanced Programmer Interrupt Controller, except it's not spelled correctly, okay. But the LAPIC EIO call tells the CPU, I'm done with this exception, please don't tell me about it anymore, basically. So we have this keyboard interrupt function, that's going to be our interesting one, so let's look at that. And that's where we're going to update the buffer that that other function was doing and possibly wake up any thread that was sleeping. And to talk about how we update the buffer, we have to talk about how do we actually interface with the keyboard? Like, how does that work in the hardware? How are we connected to the keyboard? And there are multiple ways we could do this. I'm going to talk about probably the sort of the simplest-ish and most flexible way. And that's that we're going to use our memory bus. So earlier we talked about, oh, if I want to have like multiple processors, we'll have them all connected to this bus that's connected to the memory. And an idea we can have is, well, we don't just need to have the processors and the memory on that. Why don't we put the devices on that bus? Because this is a way we already have for a processor to communicate with things that are external to the processor. Let's just take advantage of that. And so we're going to attach a device controller to the memory bus, and the device controller is going to understand how to act like memory. So the device controller, we're going to talk to it by using control registers. And we can each of these control registers is going to be assigned a memory address, just like the actual memory on the memory buses. So we can try to access these control registers by reading or writing memory locations. And since some special hardware implements these control registers, it knows when they're being read and written, and it can do special things when they're read and written. So for example, we could make it so when you say write to this write question mark control register, when you write to that memory location, this device controller, instead of just modifying a value, will all actually communicate with the external hardware in some way and send something. That's something we can implement, and why we can do that is because, well, this external hardware, it sees that write operation, and we can have hardware that does whatever we want to do on that write operation. So from the operating system, we'll just make a write to a memory location, and this device controller will turn that into an operation that, say, sends something out on the network or something like that. Commonly, our device controller will also have some sort of storage on it, like buffers or queues. And why we want this is, well, we think of our keyboard controller. We want to have storage for the key presses that haven't been sent to the OS yet, for the OS to pick them up. So we'll have some storage for that that will be accessible as a memory location. So in that case, that will act like normal memory, but it's sort of on the device controller, so the device controller can easily set it. And similarly, and probably more importantly, like for disks, we might want a bigger buffer to like store things that have just been read from the disk or just are about to be written to the disk. So besides having these special sort of memory locations, another thing we're going to need in our device controllers, we need some way of them triggering interrupts. So they're going to be able to trigger an interrupt when things happen, like a key press, or input coming in that we need to handle, or output being ready to finish. You know, on any sort of event, they can trigger interrupts, and they're connected in a way where they can do that to the interrupt controller, the part of the processor that makes exceptions happen. So questions sort of about device controllers generally. Yes?
Just one more time, what's stored in the control registers?
So the control registers, it's up to the device controller to define what they are, and what makes sense is going to vary between devices. But sort of a common example might be, let's say this is like a network controller, like the status register will be like, are we plugged in? What speed do we have? Those sorts of things. The read and writes will be slices you use to start a read or write operation, and the buffers and queues. And queues would be the data that's read or written, and maybe the status also has some information about, did a read or write finish recently or something like that. That answer your question?
Yeah.
But the details are up to the device controller designer, and what's going to make sense is going to depend on the type of device. Like the sort of design you'd want for like something that's outputting audio is probably very different than a network device. Yeah. Why we want to write information about the status of the external hardware? So the status probably isn't directly written to the external hardware, but we need some way of querying what's happening with the external hardware, right? So an example of the network device, the status is probably where we'd find out, is a cable plugged in? And the status might also be something we'd write to like configure things, right? And that would be a common type of interface to have. Does that answer your question? So the status sort of allows the device controller to configure things about the hardware which aren't about sending or receiving data, or tell the OS things about the hardware which aren't about, here's some data. Right, and as I said, this interface is up to the device controller, so you might have like a whole bunch of different status registers, you might have none, depends on the type of device you have. And sort of what information you need to get to the OS and allow the OS to change. Other questions? Okay, so I sort of showed you that, if you want to support a device, we're going to have it attached directly to the memory bus, and that's often not practical. So if you think of, for example, USB, usually you plug in a USB device into some nice standardized outlet that, is not like a memory bus, and most notably, like, it's not different on each machine, which memory buses often are, and often even things that are internal to a machine are going to have some sort of interface that's different than the memory bus. And that's okay. So we commonly have a design where we'll have what I'll call a bus adapter. So we have something attached to the memory bus that knows how to translate from what the memory bus expects to some other interface like USB or PCIX, some other more common interface, but still exposes the same sort of, interface to the processor, meaning that the OS can read or write memory locations and they'll still correspond to the device controller, but this bus adapter will do the work of translating from what we send on the memory bus to what we send on this other type of bus and vice versa. And very commonly we'll have to have bus adapters because most of our devices will not speak in the most direct way to our processor. Questions on this idea of needing bus adapters? So ultimately what we get with either version of this scheme is we have what I'll call magic memory locations. That we have memory locations which don't just store data, but we can read and write these memory locations to manipulate the device. So reading or writing a memory location might not just like get some or change some data, it will cause some hardware to do something else. So for example, a typical interface for a keyboard controller is we read from a particular memory location and it always has the last key press and release, even though we didn't put it there. And also, often, reading the location will clear the device controller buffer to be ready for the next key press. So it will know that we read it, so it knows it can put the next thing in there. you know, without us like explicitly doing something about that. And it will therefore know that it, when it needs to give us an interrupt for some new data versus when it doesn't, when we've already read it. So that's kind of magical, right? A normal memory location doesn't know if it's been read already. This one does, because our device controller can easily implement that functionality, can easily see when we've actually read from it. A display controller can make it so when we write to some memory location, if they're displayed on the screen. And maybe some other memory location changes like the screen size. You know, it's not just storage. For a network interface, we can like write something to a buffer. Well, that's not magical, but then we can write to some memory location and that will cause that buffer to be sent out on the network. You know, not just, it will trigger some operation on the device. You know, when we actually do a read or a write. So this is sort of the what this sort of interface gives us and exactly what the memory locations do, that's up for the designer of the device controller to decide what makes sense. But sort of an advantage of this is that we didn't need to add any real extra support to our processor. We kind of got this by accident because we support external memory devices. And we're just having devices look like external memory, except they just, you know, don't behave like normal memory chips. Okay, so questions? Yeah. What do I mean by magic memory? So I mean, they look like memory as far as you read and write, but they don't act like memory in that, you know, they do things besides storing data. That's the magic. So there's one little issue with this. So remember I said, oh, we could have a keyboard controller where we have this memory location which always has the latest key press and also figures out if we've read it. So let's say I press H, the OS reads that H, and if you remember, you had some prior course where you talked about processor caches, you remember that when we read something from memory, the processor tries to keep it in its local cache. And if we do that here, well, we're going to have cached that the last key press was an H. And so then I press an E, it triggers an interrupt, and the OS tries to read this last key press release location. And the natural thing would be the processor goes to the cache and says, do I have this memory location cached? The answer is yes, and it pulls out the H. It doesn't talk to the device controller, has a cached version. That's much faster. Problem is it's wrong. That the device, since this memory is magical, it doesn't act like normal memory, the value that we have cached is not going to make sense. We don't want the cache here. It's not going to help us. It's going to get rid of the magic from our memory. So we need some fix for that. And the most common solution for this is that processors have some mechanism to mark memory regions as uncacheable. So for example, on x86, there's a bit in page table entries you can set to say, don't use caching when accessing the memory using this page table entry. And the OS will arrange to set that for the parts of memory that correspond to I/O devices, to make sure we don't run into this problem where we end up reading cache data instead of actually talking to the device controller. Okay, so questions needing to not have caching. Yeah. Couldn't I implement this with like a dirty bit? So a dirty bit says, is the version in our cache newer than whatever's in the real memory? And the problem is we have the opposite situation. The version in the real memory, the device controller, is newer than the one in our cache. So conceptually, we could implement this using the same mechanism that we use to make sure caches get updated if you update a value on a different core. But usually device controllers do not implement that functionality. Instead, we rely on the OS sort of disabling caching for the memory. But conceptually, we could have device controllers do the same thing we do when another core updates a value that a core has cached. But that's pretty expensive to add to a device controller, would be my guess. Because that's called, I mentioned cache coherency earlier in the semester, and that involves every processor doing a lot of work to keep up with what's being cached. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay, so I gave you the impression that, okay, we're gonna talk to devices using our memory bus, everything's gonna have a special memory addresses, so some of the memory addresses are gonna be normal memory, some of them are gonna be device controllers. And of course, x86 is nice and historical and does something different. So x86 has something called I/O addresses. So rather than reserving certain memory addresses for device controllers, the original, like, 1980s x86 had different instructions for talking to devices. So rather than using move, you use these instructions called in and out. But other than being different instructions, they work very similarly. In is basically a move, and out is basically a move, except from an I/O address. So we have addresses, they just are a different set of addresses than we would use for physical memory. They're like physical addresses, but they're just interpreted differently to make sure they correspond to device controllers. Modern systems usually don't do this. Modern systems usually just use memory addresses, but x86 is old, and historically they had a separate I/O bus. That's why they had separate addresses. And I'm mentioning this because if you look at XV6, XV6 uses these I/O addresses. So basically, rather than having a special memory address, we have a different type of address, but the interface works the same way. There's a read and a write operation in and out. Yes?
So will there be a difference
in terms of the efficiency of the I/O and the memory address? Is there a difference in terms of the efficiency? There doesn't have to be, right? Because, you know, it's just a question of, you know, how are these instructions implemented, is the question. The history is that there used to be a separate I/O bus that was usually slower than the memory bus, and that's why we had separate addresses. This is probably not the modern implementation. Probably in modern systems, we have one sort of, or one set of external connections that's fast from the processor. It's a little more complicated because probably the processor actually still separates the real memory from the devices, even though they're conceptually on the same bus. Okay. So, but most processors use memory addresses if they've been designed more recently, just historically different. But the interface is the same. We have an in operation and out operation, just like it were memory, just accessed using different instructions. So, for example, so here's a sort of outline of the code for reading from the keyboard. We have two control registers, and I have constants to represent their addresses. I have a status register for the keyboard and a data register. These are each 1 byte, and we read the status register. We check if it indicates there's data in the buffer. It has a bit set when that's true. And if so, we read the data in the buffer, which clears the is there data in the buffer bit. And we copy that to data, and then eventually we interpret that and then send it to the input buffer that's being used by our read implementation I showed you earlier. So questions about this design? So ultimately we're just doing a read from a status register to say, is there data really? And then getting the data, then interpreting it, adding it to the buffer. But the top half of our device driver is going to use. Questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So let's say I have a system with two applications. I have one that reads from the network, and I'm going to tell you how. Another that does lots of computation, so we always have something to run. And let's say this process that reads from the network calls read to get 8 kilobytes, but there's no data available right now. And then 10 milliseconds later, 16 kilobytes of data comes in. So it's gonna get the first 8 kilobytes of that, and then we read 4 kilobytes more, so we get the next 4 kilobytes of that. And my question is, how many user kernel mode switches? And I'll, oh, whoops. I'll specify in either direction are there and how many context switches. Give you some time to think about that. I guess I should, just to make things clear, by context switches I mean between processes. Like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay. Let's see. So let's start with how many context switches. So who thinks we have at least two? More than two? Three? Four context switches? String context switches? Okay. So more than four? Okay. So we have some variation there. Okay. So we have a plurality on two. How about user kernel mode switches in either direction? So if you're only counting one direction, probably double the number you have. So who thinks we have at least two? At least four? At least six? At least eight? Okay, so we have a pretty good consensus on six. Assuming, or around six. So six is the number I got. Let's go through what I think happens here. So we have A is running initially. It calls the read system call. Remember, that's going to check, is there data in the buffer? And the answer is no. So we're going to put A to sleep. And when we put A to sleep, we're not just going to leave the CPU idle. If you have something to do, we can run B. If B is doing a big computation, presumably that computation is in user mode. So we're going to switch to B and also switch to user mode to run B. Computation. And eventually, we're going to get some data on the network. That's going to trigger an exception of some sort. That's going to run the bottom half of our network device driver, and it's going to copy from the device. And then, when it's done copying, it's going to say, oh, now I can run this program that was waiting. It's going to wake up process A. And two things could happen. So one thing that could happen is we could decide that our scheduling policy says, oh, A is runnable, better run it right away. Maybe A has higher priority, you know, than B. Another thing we could decide is that maybe it isn't important to run A, and we'll just go back to running B in user mode. Either is possible. Eventually, for whatever reason, we decide to switch to A, and we're going to finish that read system call. And this time we're going to go back and copy data from the buffer into the place specified by read. And then we're going to return from it. Program A is going to run long enough to make its second system call. And this time we're going to look in the buffer and we're going to say, oh, I have 8 kilobytes of data left. I can do a 4 kilobyte read with that. And we're going to satisfy that immediately. We aren't going to have to wait for anything to do that because the buffer already has that data. So I count, assuming we run A right away, 6 mode switches. If we don't run A right away, 8 mode switches. And 2 context switches. Some questions? How I came up with those answers? Yeah. Yeah, so question is what the gray block is. So the gray block is if we decide to keep running B rather than switching to A right away, then that's where we're gonna run B. If not, nothing happens there. If we decide to run A right away, we just go right to A's finishing up the read system call. And that's gonna depend on our scheduling policy. Like if B has higher priority, well, we're gonna keep running B. That answer your question? Why do we increase the number of context switches? Because to keep running B, we need to go back to user mode. But we switch to kernel mode to handle the exception from the network device. Other questions? Okay, so what I've talked about so far here, note that we have this time where we're spending time copying things from the device. So the device has some buffer, we're copying from that into the kernel buffer, and this is called programmed I/O, that the OS runs some loop to transfer data to and from the device controller. It seems like the most natural thing to do. The device controller, you know, has a place to store the stuff it gets from the disk or the network or whatever, and we copy from that. And typically triggered by an interrupt. There's another design that is very common and more efficient. So something we can observe is that, you know, this is kind of slow, and our device controller, it's on the memory bus. Just like the processor can talk to the memory, the device controller can talk to the memory. It can send something directly to the memory or read something directly from the memory. So what we'll do is we'll have, instead of having a buffer on the device, we'll get rid of that buffer, and we'll have a control register specifying an address in memory to put a buffer that the OS will write, and then when the device controller, say, wants to store data, rather than storing in an internal buffer, it will just write it to that memory location directly. And this saves, hopefully, the OS from having to copy from the device buffer into its own. We can just say, here's my buffer, it's an address 9000, please write to it. And the device controller can just do that directly for us rather than having an extra copy operation. And this is known as direct memory access. And when we set that up, the OS just reads from its buffer as usual, hopefully. And this avoids that extra work of copying. Skip that slide because that's complicated to explain. And it's for things like memory, for disk I/O and network stuff, it's much faster because we have lots of data to copy. It's much faster if the device controller just reads it from our memory directly or writes it directly there rather than having this extra step where we put it in a buffer, copy that buffer to the device. The device can do that while we're doing something else with the CPU. So we can run B and have the device controller copying stuff while B is doing computation. And hopefully the device controller puts the data where the OS wants it directly. It doesn't always work out. Sometimes there's restrictions that prevent that, but usually get at least closer to that idea. So this idea is known as direct memory access, and some device controllers will support it. Sort of instead of having their own buffers, the OS will give a memory location to use to store data being sent to the device or read from the device. Questions on direct memory access? Yes?
So is that in the specified within the device controller interface?
Question, is that specified in the device controller interface? Yeah, so the device controller is going to have a different interface, right? We'll change having a buffer to have this address. Other questions? Yeah?
So there's like two methods, right? Normally, we would just either read or write directly to the device's buffer.
So question is, there's two methods. Normally we read and write to the device buffer, but in case the CPU is busy. It's not in case the CPU is busy. This is a different design for the device controller. So supporting direct memory access means the device controller hardware is more complicated, but also that we free up the CPU to do other stuff.
If we didn't have this complication, what would the CPU do normally?
It would copy from the device controller directly. Why can't we just read the record from the device controller? So the problem is, like, for example, in the case of a network, like, I'm limited to how much space does the device controller have to store that. If I want to move the data somewhere and read something else, I need to copy it away because I have to use that buffer. Like, I can't change it. And generally, I want to move things out of that buffer and free up more space so the device controller can, like, read in more stuff or write out more stuff. And that involves copying with the programmed I/O approach, but with the direct memory access approach, I can just give a different memory address. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So that's where we'll finish up today. Next time we'll talk about file systems.